Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 135 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, poet Claire Shaw speaks with Jeff Hattersley about the origins of her love of poetry, the legacy of mental illness in her writing, and her drive to find the light in even the darkest material.
Claire Shaw was born in Burnley, Lancashire, in 1972. Following a young adulthood marked by self-harm and spells in various psychiatric units, she is now a recognised authority on women's mental health issues, and her poetry reflects these concerns. Her first collection, Straight Ahead, published by Blood Axe Books in 2006, was shortlisted for the Glenn Dimplex New Writers Award for Poetry and attracted a Forward Prize highly commended for Best Single Poem. It was followed in 2012 by Head On, which is one of the most powerful books of poetry written by an English person that I've read for years. I was excited at the chance to speak to Claire about these poems, and met her at her home on a typically rainy day in the picturesque West Yorkshire village of Hebden Bridge. Well, hello Claire, it's good to see you.
And, likewise, Jeff.
I thought I'd start off by asking a little bit about your family background. I read that you're the youngest of six children brought up in Burnley.
That's right.
Was it a happy childhood?
Well, like most writers, it was a mixture. I wouldn't say it was entirely happy. I wouldn't say it was entirely unhappy. And I think like most writers, I end up gravitating towards the unhappy when I'm writing. Youngest of six and single parent family. So my dad left the family when we were four. So it was an upbringing with lots and lots of independence. I think that's one positive way of framing it. So lots of time of going off on my own and kind of being my own boss, because parental kind of presence was really limited. There was a lot to be said for that, as well as a lot to be said against it. So I didn't get the looking after that I might have needed. And again, that's given me lots to write about. But it gave me lots and lots of space. Grew up in Burnley, which is quite a grim industrial northern town with lots and lots of problems. But one of the really great things about Burnley is the landscape. So it's near some absolutely beautiful countryside. We're right under the shadow of Pendle. We grew up next to a park, so from a really young age, I was roaming round the park under my own steam. And then from probably 10 or 11 onwards, I was off and out. So my teenage years, I spent loads of time up Pendle. We moved over to Little Town, kind of on the slopes of Pendle. Again, a very grim little town, Priorfield. And I could get up Pendle. I think I timed myself once and I could get up there under an hour. I could get up there probably in about 45 minutes. So lots and lots of open space where I guess I sort of came to creativity in some ways because of that space.
Did you have an interest in poetry then, or is that something that came much later?
No, that came really early. Again, I think probably a common theme in lots of writers' lives, lots of people's lives. I had a single teacher that I could kind of very directly credit with coming to poetry. Her name was Mrs. O'Hara. She was a really interesting character anyway. So O'Hara, Catholic woman, her maiden name was Krzyszelnicka. So she came from Poland, and her family, a lot of her family were in concentration camps during the Second World War. I was 7 or 8 when I was in Mrs. O'Hara's class, and she spoke a lot about those experiences. So she kind of didn't hold back. She didn't think that was territory that very young children couldn't engage with. I remember her talking about her auntie being part of the kind of medical experiments and being made to stand in freezing mud for kind of 3 days solid to experiment on the kind of impact on the body of cold temperatures. That's part of that story that's really stuck with me. And she read us like The Silver Sword. She read us I Am David. And she was really passionate about creative writing. So that's what it was called at the time, creative writing. And I'd always read a lot. I read a lot as a child, stories, books. I remember Jeanette Winterson telling the story of figuring out how many books she could fit under the single mattress in her bed and hide from her mum. I didn't have to hide my books, but we weren't allowed to read after we went to bed. And I used to read by any light possible and then hide the books under my pillow. And I remember having like a stack of books so high I could barely sleep under my pillow. So always really passionate about reading. But Mrs. O'Hara, I think, really kind of woke me up to poetry and was so encouraging. I loved writing stories and I loved writing poetry. And she was so enthusiastic about my ability that I think I really ran from there. I think she was sort of the door opening for me.
Well, I know that as a young woman, you had some psychiatric issues. And since then, you've become, as well as being a poet and performer, active in mental health education, is that right?
And, yeah.
I wondered if you wanted to say something about that and perhaps on how it may have impacted upon your poetry or influenced that.
Oh, wow. It's impacts on just about every level of what I write. So it kind of impacts on it in terms of content. It impacts on what I've written about because I've written very directly from those experiences. But it also impacts at a really core level. So I think just kind of talking about experiences themselves, quite right, psychiatric issues as a young woman, and that continued for a long time. So it's not something that I necessarily look on as something that I struggled with in my past life and now it's all gone away and it's an ongoing issue for me. Yeah, so I grew up in Burnley and I moved away, went to Liverpool University. But I had struggled for a long time. I struggled through my teenage years. And I found an escape and a kind of expression, really, in work. Largely an escape initially. So I worked like a demon. Kind of the more I struggled, the harder I worked. And I guess for lots of people, that kind of obscured the fact that I was struggling because I was a high flyer academically. So I managed to make it to third year in university before the whole kind of house of cards tumbled. I had a massive breakdown, went into hospital. And in short, spent about 6 years in and out of various psychiatric units, acquired a whole list of different diagnoses. And they were, as you can imagine, incredibly tough years. And it was incredibly tough to kind of come back from that place. A lot to write about. So not just writing about kind of the experience of distress, which is fairly difficult to write about, certainly as an abstract, but lots of kind of very interesting stuff to write about. So I was in inner city hospitals, inner city psychiatric units, and they are a place where you meet very interesting people. That feels slightly euphemistic. So, yeah, inner city psychiatric ward, you've got people often in very, very florid states of psychosis at the kind of extremes of the mental health experience and with many extremely interesting stories to tell. I was on a dormitory with an alcoholic nun for quite a long time. I was there with the daughter of a very famous soup magnate. People who had a lot to talk about and that there was lots to say about, not just their kind of mental health issues, but their kind of life experiences. So impossible, really, for that not to enter my work. But other than kind of just telling the story of this is what happened to me, this is who I met, this is what it was like, I think the way that it sort of shaped my creativity or shape my poetry, it's more at the level of an absolute passion for language. So for me, and everybody's story is very different, for me, I would see the roots of my mental health difficulties as being about lacking language. So although I was very articulate, you know, I had a really wide vocabulary from a very young age, and as I said, always read very widely. Because of my upbringing, because of my family background, I'd always been given a very clear message that it wasn't okay to talk about how you felt. It wasn't okay to name what was difficult. It wasn't okay to name it for myself, let alone to name it for other people. And that, for me, Well, first of all, it led to me becoming very depressed, because depression is all about pushing down feeling and experience. And it meant that when those feelings and experiences needed an outlet, it had to be in behaviour. And for me, that was often around self-injury and suicide. So the journey back from self-injury and suicide has been about discovering language. And it's been about finding a language that for me could capture feeling and capture experience and do that in a way that was meaningful for other people. So as I say again, right at the very, very core of my creativity is that deep sort of very personal, emotional passion for language, because for me it was about redemption. I think I write because it feels necessary, and it feels necessary to write because of the level of passion. And I don't think I can write without that level of feeling.
It's rage at the way the world is, you know, and the way it could be and should be. What lies behind most of the books? Would you say that that's right? That gives you the intensity?
I think you're right. And I also hope that the same place that that fury comes from is a place of kind of love and connection. I love Selima Hill. I love her and I love her writing. And I came to that kind of very early on in my own writing. And it opened a lot of doors for me in terms of, my God, you can write like this. This is extraordinary. You can write about these things in this way. And I remember a line of hers, all poetry is love poetry. You know, and she similarly has written about kind of very walking through the flames. You know, she writes about, literally, about the experience of being burnt. She writes about trauma. She writes about her time in hospital. And for her to kind of frame that as love poetry, that you need to be in love with the world to be able to write like that, I really hope that that's part of what I do and certainly part of what I can move into most. To be furious about things, I think you have to care about them really deeply. And that is a place of love as much as a place of other kind of darker feelings. So it's kind of staying open, I guess, to the fury and the place that it comes from, also being a place of light. And I guess I'd say that's true, you know, through all my sort of experiences, my time in hospital, my time recovering from really, really severe mental health problems, was that there was enough light in that darkness to kind of find a way forwards. And even though I kind of still struggle, I think most people do. And it's inevitable that we all struggle at times, that it's about kind of just keeping, even if it's a memory of light, keeping a sense of that, enough of it to keep going.
Oh yeah, well, it's uplifting to know that somebody's putting these poems together, cares so deeply, and putting them out there into the world, you know. I know that it says in the blurb that you write as a poet to speak to the world, and that the world's not really listening. How do you feel about that, though? You know, or does it even matter? I mean, as a poet, really, all we should do is be witnesses to the horror, do you think? It doesn't matter if we're here and the world's somewhere over there taking very little notice.
I think that it is, though, Jeff. I think maybe that's part of, while I kind of sometimes wade in very dark material and dark places, so my work in mental health takes me into some incredibly difficult settings. So thinking of prisons and secure psychiatric units where people are sort of at the extremes of the difficulties that life can throw, and the systems are some of the most difficult systems that you can ever negotiate. I'm kind of sustained by what I sometimes suspect is a slightly benignly naive feeling that people do listen and that you do bring about change. I've recently come to Buddhism, which has been really important for me. And I guess it's given a sort of spiritual framework for that belief. So there's talk in Buddhism of the human revolution. And it's replicated in lots and lots of different frameworks, intellectual, spiritual, it doesn't matter. But the belief that if you change yourself, that you change people around you, that if you can kind of bring about change in one person, that's enough of a difference. We might not be able to make things better in Syria But if we can make things better in our own lives, that's a revolution in itself. And I find that really, really important. It stops things seeming overwhelming and hopeless in the way that they could otherwise.
Oh, yeah, I agree with you. You know, poetry can transform the way people think, inform them and educate them. I was thinking more in the terms of we can't affect, say, politicians. You know, I wrote a lot of poems during the miners' strike, but it didn't affect the way the miners' strike went. You know, and so that's kind of very frustrating for me. It's not that many people are ever going to take notice of what you do, but it's important that we do it. I've always felt that. Even if you just change one person's mind or make them aware of something they weren't aware of before, then that is worth doing.
Yeah, I think it didn't influence the outcome of the miners' strike, but poetry and music absolutely influenced the miners.
Right.
Was part of that movement. You know, if we think about radical grassroots political movements, they're absolutely sustained by, you know, oral tradition, song, poetry, speaking out, stories, listening to each other. That's where it comes from. And I think we're all politicians, so yeah, absolutely, bloody hell, you know, the thought that people in Parliament aren't listening. But if we're listening to each other, we're all politicians in the sense that we all shape each other's worlds and we all have a certain amount of power. I'm still very much wedded to the belief that it does make a difference. And again, kind of thinking back to, you know, some of those very difficult places where I sometimes work. I remember going into the library at New Old Prison, which is a women's prison, very large one in Yorkshire, to meet with a librarian there. And she said the most popular books there are poetry. Actually, to the extent that there are some that were so regularly nicked or had pages torn out of them, she now has to keep them behind the desk. And women come in and ask for particular poems and she'll do a photocopy. Poetry is really alive in people's lives, particularly in extreme times. So when I'm thinking about psychiatric system in prisons, it's in extremely dark times, but it's alive and in people's lives at extremely happy times, like births and marriages and when they fall in love. People turn to poetry. They don't write a book, they don't write a song. They want to write poems and they want to read poetry that kind of reflects and expresses and makes sense of where they're at. So I do really believe that it does make a difference.
Yeah, well, good. I'm glad you do. I think I do, really. I'm just a sad, cynical old git, really.
Bless your heart. I don't believe that, really, Jack.
The older I get, the more dispirited I get, I must admit. But yeah, you can
keep it going. You're still smiling.
Words can change the world. And I mean, just as an example, and I mean, it's pushing the definition of poetry, but say, I think what Bob Geldof did with his song in the 80s changed the world. It really did.
Yeah.
Made far more people aware of what were going on.
Yeah.
Far more generous. And so there's one example of words which have changed the world.
Yeah, that's a great example. And lots of people had difficulties with it in different ways, but it still had a huge, huge impact. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, you've got a reputation as being quite a dynamic performer of your work. And
oh, cool. I'm glad about that.
Well, that's also once. Carolyn Duffy said you're one of the best young writers on the circuit at the moment. Or something.
Yes, she did, yeah. That was a while ago. I hope she still thinks that. My claim to being young is dying away, but maybe it's still live in the world of poetry. But yeah, I love reading. And it's absolutely sort of part of the writing process for me. You know, I think it's kind of standard advice, isn't it, that when you write, make sure that you're reading it out to yourself, you'll notice stuff. I like to learn my stuff off by heart. I'll often recite my poem when I'm driving and I'll notice the glitches in it, I'll notice the repetitions and the weaknesses in that process of saying it out loud. I write for an audience, not in the sense that I write deliberately with a certain audience in mind, but I write to be read, I write to be listened to. I'm not Emily Dickinson. The whole point for me is that I have a sense that people will read and will listen. And when there's that direct communication, when I know somebody's going to read it, when I know somebody's going to listen, then a whole new level of kind of poetic awareness kicks in and I will edit it much more heavily and much more critically than I will do. Otherwise, I have to know it's going to be seen.
So would you ever perhaps redraft a piece due to an audience reaction to it or not?
No, I might love it more or love it less. If it's at a point where I feel it's finished, I wouldn't necessarily change it as a result of getting lots of oohs and ahs or lots of silence and baffled murmurs. Certainly feedback is part of the writing process, putting together a collection or a kind of sequence, a bigger body of work. I'd show it to trusted friends, checking out what they thought of it. It's really important to me to get that, and I do take feedback really seriously. I don't take it absolutely, but that sense of it being really important to find out if people get it, if it works. If I'm not communicating what I want to communicate, then it's failed. But balancing that with a sense of staying true to my own voice. So you might really not like that, but I know it's really important to me to keep that in there. My kind of advice to the new or young writers that I'm working with is when some critical feedback kind of rings a little bit true, it rings with maybe a small doubt that you had yourself, then it's probably right. Go with it, listen to it.
I did notice that in your first book, there was quite a lot more humour than in the second book. I mean, there were some heavy pieces in the first book too.
Yeah.
But not in the same kind of unrelenting, head-on way of the second, if you like. I remember seeing you read at the Albert, which may have been your first reading there, and laughing quite a lot, you know. Lines like, you're on a bus and or a train, and these couple were discussing whether you were a man or a woman.
Oh, yeah.
Laugh out loud lines, you know. So my question is, where are you going from here? Since Head On, would you say your work is increasing in that dark vein? Or?
Oh my God, I hope not. No, I would say absolutely not. What I've noticed is a kind of movement on from that. It wasn't a dark place, but I guess when I wrote Head On, it felt very important to engage with, as I say, just some dark material that was around. And I guess maybe it kind of reflects something about my life journey. There was, in Head On, a determination to kind of find the light within it, because that was necessary. It was necessary for the writing, but it was necessary for me. And I think probably it does reflect where I'm at. But it probably reflects where I want to be at with my writing as well. It's time to move on from that. So it's reflecting my own experience of kind of moving out, widening my gaze in terms of my own life, in terms of my own experiences and the people around me. But it's also about reflecting. I think that's necessary for my writing. I don't want to keep writing about trauma and dark things. I think it's really, really necessary to write from kind of calmer, quieter, as I say, more contented places. And that has at times felt quite challenging, but I've certainly noticed, and the people that I've shown my work to have noticed, that that has been the shift in more recent writing. So I'm just thinking, as an example, I've just written a really long sequence of poems about flooding. We're sitting here in my house in Hebden Bridge. I live right in the centre of Hebden Bridge. Before that, I lived in between Todmorden and Hebden Bridge on the banks of the canal, right next to the river. Before that, I lived right in the centre of Todmorden. So I've lived in, you know, the very centre of flood zones for like 12 years now, longer. And I noticed flood as a theme. It was there in my first collection. It was there as in my second collection. It's bound to be. It's part of my everyday awareness every time it rains. So I wanted to write a long sequence about flooding, and I wanted to use flooding as a metaphor. It's a really obvious, really open metaphor for loads of stuff. And I set myself January as the deadline for this sequence, and was really strict about that. I needed to finish the sequence by the end of January. Boxing Day, we were neck deep in water. Not this house, the cellar flooded, but it didn't come in this house. But everything around me was neck deep. Schools, the shops, the town was absolutely ruined, and friends lost everything. It was terrible. So it was really hard to finish this sequence from the middle of the material, but it still felt really, really important to find some redemption in that material. And actually it was there in, to coin a phrase, Bucket Loads. You know, the very last poem in that sequence is called Flood as Redemption. And it was there all around me. So the town was devastated and people's lives were devastated. But from Boxing Day onwards, so, you know, Boxing Day was terrible, it was traumatic, it felt like a bloody war zone. From the next day onwards, you couldn't have believed it if you hadn't seen it. You know, hordes of people, literally, it looked like an army, descended on Hebden Bridge. People couldn't get into Hebden Bridge at that point. People came down from the hills with buckets and spades and food. So the sense that something terrible has happened to the town, but the sense of kind of love and unity and solidarity and optimism was completely overwhelming in another way. It was another kind of flood. Yeah, so I feel really confident, actually, that the next collection, that's there in a very kind of obvious and direct way.
OK, well, thanks very much for that, Claire. So I think perhaps we'll wrap it up now. It's been a real pleasure talking to you.
A pleasure talking to you as well, Jeff. We talked about things I didn't expect to talk about, but it was great.
That was Claire Shaw in conversation with Jeff Hattersley. You can find out more about Claire on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 135, which was recorded by Jeff Hattersley and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 136, non-fiction writer Roy Bainton speaks with Frances Burns about the stories an adventurous life accumulates, the increasing difficulty of surviving as a freelancer, and the way music and writing come together as a cornerstone of his career. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.